All right, we're ready for Luke chapter 23 in our study this morning. And this is the outline that we are following. We are in the last section, obviously, because next week, Lord willing, we'll wind up with chapter 24 and finish the Gospel of Luke and ready then for John starting in January. But we're in this section of the final tragedy and triumph. We're going to review some of our chapters because we have an amount of material to cover. I'm just going to hit some of the high points of our chapter review. Let's come down here to chapter 6. What's chapter 6 about? That's where the Sermon on the Mount is. Yes, very good. Let's get chapter 9. Discipleship. Remember chapter 10 had to do with the spreading of the message? Let's come to chapter 15. Value of the lost, demonstrated in how many parables? Three. All right. Let's get chapter 18. Yes, very good. Chapter 20. All right. Chapter 19 was that triumphal entry. And then the confrontation in chapter 20. And then we had the destruction of Jerusalem, chapter 22, last time. All right, he was betrayed and arrested. What's chapter 23 about? Question number one for today. All right, he is tried and he is crucified. We have been following this calendar of the Passion Week, as we often refer to it, the last week of the life of Christ, and we've been moving our highlight over as we go along, and we've talked about each one of those days, and we are on Friday. This is where he was arrested, this is where he was tried, and this is where he was crucified. And some of you have been marking in the margin of your text, so if you're ready to do that, mark here at chapter 23 that the predominant part of the chapter should be labeled as Friday. Now let's get ahead of ourselves and jump over to the end of the chapter. And over at verse 56, they rested on the Sabbath. Well, that's obviously Saturday. So if you're flagging days, and we've got one more to flag, and that's next week, which is the first day of the week in chapter 24, which is obviously Sunday. So we've got this entire calendar flagged in our text now. Make sense? So we're at Friday is where we are, and we won't see this calendar again today. We'll see it next time. So here's what happens in chapter 23. We have the Roman trial. We'll distinguish that from the Jewish trial in just a moment. So we've got the Roman trial, and then we have the crucifixion, and then we have his burial. Now, I want to review just a little bit of where we were and correct something from last time. The trial of Jesus involved two major trials. There was the Jewish trial and the Roman trial, consisting of three hearings each. We've mentioned that every time we've come through Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and John. What I mentioned last time, I said that Luke identifies four of the six, and then I said, well, actually five. I want to correct that. Actually, six. All six of these are alluded to. Five are mentioned specifically, and the other is alluded to. So all six of these are actually found in Luke. So let's flag those if you hadn't already. At chapter 22 and verse 54, when they went to the high priest house, that would be Annas. He was the high priest, recognized as the high priest. He had been the Romans are the ones who had removed him from that office and insisted that Caiaphas be high priest. So they still recognized Annas, but legally there must be Caiaphas to be legal in the eyes of the Romans at least. So that's why we have him at Annas. Then we have Caiaphas at verse 63 and the Sanhedrin. And then at verse 66 of Luke chapter 22, we have him before the Sanhedrin again. And we'll say more about that in a moment. Then today we're going to see him before Pilate, before Herod, and Pilate again. So all six are mentioned in Luke. Only the first one is just briefly alluded to, and Annas is not mentioned. So I wanted to correct that from last time. All right, here's what happened in the Jewish trial. He went before Annas, not much of a trial here. He was arrested around midnight or so. These are approximate times. And what I want you to see before we get through is from the time of his arrest to the time of the trial being over is by 6 the next morning. If you can imagine someone being arrested last night at midnight after you went to bed, and by the time you got up this morning, he's been through 6 hearings and 2 trials. That's kind of a sham of a trial, isn't it? very illegal. We'll allude to some of the illegality of that here in a moment. But they went before Annas, and he questioned him about his disciples and doctrine, and the officer struck him, and Jesus said, if I've done evil, what evidence? And if not, why did you strike me? And then they send him off to Caiaphas in the middle of the night. This is illegal. They have no authority before daylight, before the morning sacrifice. But this is recorded in Luke chapter 22, and they gave false testimony concerning the temple. Jesus was silent. They asked him if he was the Son of God. He said yes. Caiaphas said he's guilty of blasphemy and no more witnesses needed. And they said he's worthy of death. They blindfolded him and spat on him and beat him and they struck him. And so after the morning sacrifice, that is in the early hours of the morning, they go before the Sanhedrin to make this more legal. Quote. And so, are you the Christ? Well, if I tell you, you won't believe. And if I ask you, you won't answer me or let me go. He claimed to be the Son of God. Are you the Son of God? I am. We have no need of further witness. So they carry him off to the Romans. He's been through three trials, and we're about 6 o'clock in the morning, 5 to 6 o'clock in the morning. Making sense? All right. Now we're ready for the Roman trial. That's what we're going to see in our study today. So let's get started with verse 1 and start talking about this Roman trial before Pilate. So we have him before Pilate. And we'll summarize what the other accounts have to say here in a moment. So we do have some ground to cover. Who is Pilate? Well, Pilate was governor, as we refer to him, of Judea. More technically, he was referred to as the prefect of Judea. And so basically, he's a Roman ruler that rules over Judea. He's to control Judea. And any uprising, he's responsible to kind of snuffing that uprising out. And hence, one of the charges is going to be made at verse 2 here in a moment. All right. What are the accusations made in verses 1 and 2? They come before Pilate, and what are the accusations they accuse him of? There are three. Perverting the nation. We'll come back to that. Second, forbidding to pay taxes. And thirdly, calls himself a king. Well, all of that should ring a bell or shoot a flag up for Pilate. One is perverting the nation. That's kind of a vague charge, perverting the nation. I take it that that's the charge, that he's stirring up this nation. He's agitating this nation. And by the way, and an inference to that is to Pilate. Pilate, you're supposed to keep an eye on this. Here's a man that's stirring up the people and is stirring up an uprising. And you better keep your eye on him. And we're bringing him to you. This is what he's guilty of. And he's forbidding to pay taxes. Is that true? That's not a true statement. That's an outright lie. In fact, when he was asked about whose money this is, he said, give unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's. They're lying about that. And then the third charge, that he claims to be a Christ, the king, a king. Is that true? Yes, but not in the sense they're claiming. What are they claiming? A material kingdom, that he's trying to supplant the Roman Empire. He's going to overthrow you, Pilate. He's going to overthrow the emperor. He's going to be the king. He's going to be the emperor, he's claiming. So those are the charges. All right. Pilate asked him, what?
He said, are you the king of the Jews? He said,
yes. In other words, the answer is yes. So Pilate then said, I find no fault with this man. In other words, I find no basis, no evidence that indeed he's guilty of the things y'all are charging him with. And I've got no interest in this, and so I find no fault in this man. But they were more fierce, saying he stirs up the people, teaching throughout all Judea, beginning from Galilee to this place. In other words, you don't understand how bad this guy is. He's stirring up the people, and this is the kind of thing, Pilate, you need to keep your eye on, and you're in charge of. And so when Pilate heard about that, he's ready to send him off. Now, that's before Pilate. So here's the fourth hearing. This is the first hearing in the Roman trial. And so every account, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, so you're going to hear some things as we run through this that you didn't see here, but it's mentioned in the other accounts, particularly Matthew. When they came before Pilate, Pilate said, what is the accusation? And this is interesting. They said, if he were not an evildoer, we wouldn't have brought him to you. That's not much of a charge, is it? Can you imagine going before a judge now and say, Judge, put him in jail. Well, why should I put him in jail? Well, if he hadn't done wrong, we wouldn't have brought him. Go ahead and slam him in jail. It's kind of silly, isn't it? And Pilate said, you judge him according to your law. And here's the three accusations they made. Are you king? He said, yes. And do you hear what they say? And then John records that when Jesus mentioned he had a kingdom according to truth, remember him asking the question, what is truth? And then walked out. And he said, I find no fault with this man. And so that's the fourth hearing. But when he heard he was from Galilee, why did he send him to Herod? He's over Galilee. So let's talk about Herod Antipas here for a moment. Who is this Herod? He's king over Galilee and Perea. So he is of that region where the charge is he's creating sedition or problems in Galilee, even down to here. Let me send him to Herod. This is Herod Antipas. He's the son of Herod the Great. He is the one who killed John the Baptist. Remember that? He's the one that, or his dad was the one who tried to kill Jesus as a baby. And so he sends him before Herod to be tried before Herod. So let's see what happens in this trial before Herod. He asked him some questions, verses 6 to 9. He happened to be in Jerusalem at the time. And before he asked him questions, verse 8, I think we had a question on that. Where did I put my questions? Question number 4, what was he hoping to accomplish by seeing Jesus? He's hoping to see a miracle. Now, this is the same man that beheaded John. And you remember, he had some kind of appreciation for John. Even though he took his head off eventually, he heard John and heard him frequently and had some degree of respect for John. And yet, because he got caught between a rock and a hard place, he had his head taken off. He had heard some things about Jesus. He had heard about his miracles. He's hoping to see one of those miracles. And so he was glad when he had the opportunity to hear him. Now, verse 9 said he questioned him with many words, and Jesus responded by answering nothing. He's within his legal right to do that. But what was the questions? Well, none of the accounts tell us what those questions were. And so we can't trace over to the other accounts and say, well, here are the three questions he asked him. He questioned him about a number of things. We're not told exactly what they were. And then the chief priest and the scribes vehemently accused him. So they're making the charges. They go to Herod, and they're trying to see that the Romans execute him. We want this carried out. We want him killed. And so they make accusations. All the accusations are not revealed. Now, verses 11 and 12, what did Herod and his men of war, in other words, his troops, soldiers around him, do? Yeah, they mocked him, ridiculed him. They treated him with contempt, and they put on him a gorgeous robe. What does that suggest? Mocking him. They're ridiculing. You say you're king? You claim to be king? We'll make you a king. Here's a robe. And then they send him away to Pilate. Now, interesting verse 12. What do you learn from verse 12? Maybe Herod will deal with him. Send him over there to Herod. And they became friends because before this, there had been enmity between them, but they developed some friendship. Quite often, if you have a common enemy, you have a friendship develop because there's a common enemy. You can't stand each other, but we hate the same person. So if we hate the same person, then we can get along. And that was the case here. Questions or comments up to this point? Had to, because that was the work of John. If John did any teaching at all before him, he had to tell him about the Messiah and why the Messiah was so important. All right, there's not much to summarize because we saw everything that we can find right here in Luke, and that is this fifth hearing now, and these are again proximate times, sometime before 6 o'clock, we're already in our fifth hearing. And we're talking about a short distance to go from Herod from Pilate over to Herod and back to Pilate, from the Sanhedrin court over to Pilate. We're not talking about a great deal of time that would take to go from one to the other. It's not like going from here to Nashville and then coming back. We're talking about going from here, not even to town, and then back, and then maybe over here to just a mile or two away. We're talking very, very short distance. We'll come to that on a map here in a moment. But Herod asked him questions. He didn't answer. They make accusations, and he treated him with contempt and sent him off. Let's go back to Pilate. I don't want to deal with him. I don't know what to do with him. All right, now we're ready for the last hearing, and we're going to flag some times here before we get through right here at verse 25. And so we'll get ready to do that here in just a moment. Now he comes before Pilate again, and so let's go to verses 13 to 17. What does Pilate say when he comes back? Yeah, I don't find anything worthy of death. So let's start at verse 13. He called them together and he said, "You have brought this man to me," verse 14 I'm reading, "as one who misleads the people, and indeed having examined him in your presence, I find no fault in this man concerning the things of which you accuse him." In other words, you make accusations. He's creating an uprising. He's stirring the people. He's seeking to be king. And I hadn't seen any evidence of that. I haven't seen that there's a big threat here. And I find no. And no, neither did Herod. Now, your New King James is interesting here. Awkward wording. "For I sent you back to him." Your English Standard, American Standard, the American Standard particularly is more wooden and literal. And the English Standard renders this, and your footnote will suggest, "He sent him back to us," which is exactly what happened. That's all it's saying. That Herod couldn't find any problem with him, found no fault with him, so he sent him back over here to me. Sent him back down to the kind of the lower court. Now notice at verse 16, you might flag this, and we'll talk about the details of this in a moment. "I will therefore chastise him and release him." He's talking about scourging. Might make a marginal note. He's going to scourge him. Now, what is that? We'll come to that in a moment. So let's just save our comments about that. If you get ahead of yourself down to verse 22, he again says, "I will therefore chastise him." So let me do this for you. You think he's worthy of punishment. I'm not going to kill him, but what I'm going to do is I'm going to scourge him, just give him a beating, and then we'll release him. That's what he wants to do. Now, verse 17. Your translation may be missing that. If you're reading from the English Standard, it's not there. And you'll find a footnote that says some translations put it here between verse 16 and 18, and some put it after verse 18, just before verse 19. And some are missing it altogether. That's a textual issue. Has to do with it missing from many of the manuscripts. It is thought, it's a common thought, and it may be correct, that this was a scribal insert. I don't think that doesn't make me question inspiration at all. It's thought to be a scribal insert as an explanation. That why is it that they're releasing somebody? Well, verse 17 said it was necessary for him to release them at the feast. That was the custom of the time, that he would release one. What was the custom about? Well, some commentators suggest, and probably correct, that the Jews felt like the Romans had their thumb on them. Pretty hard. And to get the Jews to go along with them better, when they'd have their feast, they'd let one go as kind of a good measure token to the Jews. "I'll release one of your prisoners to you. You pick the one that you want to release, and I'll release one every time we have a feast." So that was kind of a good measure token to them, because they felt like they were under the thumb of Rome. So whether verse 17 is in the text or is it missing, it's a fact, and it doesn't shake our faith if it's there or if it's missing at all. All right, let's start at verse 18. What happens in verses 18 to 23? All right, yeah, they want to release Barabbas. Let's go to question number 6. Who is this Barabbas? Say again. He was a murderer, and he was in prison for insurrection. Don't you find that quite interesting? Here's a man who was guilty of insurrection. The Jews acknowledge he was, and Pilate doesn't dispute that. He's guilty of insurrection and murder. He's a threat to the people, but you need to do away with Jesus because he's trying to create an insurrection. That was the charge. Wasn't true, but this is why he's a dangerous man. But we want you to release Barabbas, who we know is an insurrectionist, and he's a murderer. Release him to us. So the explanation is given at verse 19. Therefore, he was wanting to release Jesus, called out to them again, and their reaction, verse 21, shouted even louder. What are they saying? Crucify him, crucify him. We want him crucified. He asked, what evil has he done? I find no cause of death in him. I will therefore chastise him. But they were more insistent, verse 23, and the voices of these men prevailed, and of the chief priest is a questionable phrase. I'll leave that to you to decide. But anyway, the voices of the men, of the people, of the crowd, of the mob, prevailed. They shout and they shout and they shout, and we want Barabbas. So let's get 24 and 25, and then we'll summarize all of that and flag some time, get a time stamp. At verse 24, Pilate gave them the sentence as they requested, and he did what? Verse 25. All right. They released Jesus to their will, but he gave them Barabbas, and again identified as an insurrectionist and a murderer, and delivered Jesus then to their will. Let's give a stamp, time stamp here. Let's go to John 19 and in verse 4. Now, this may not help you, but it helps me to get a mental picture of the time frame that we're talking about and how we came up with these times that we've been talking about right here on our slides. Go to John 19 and verse 14. I said 4, didn't I? 14. Thank you very much. Now, this was the preparation day of the Passover, about the sixth hour. Now, this is Roman time being identified here, which would be about 6 a.m. So you might flag John 19, 14 over at verse 25 of our text in Luke 23. You say, why am I making a note about that? The trial was ended by 6 a.m. Does that make sense? So I say these are approximate times. This is the last hearing, and it's over about 6 a.m. Rested about midnight. Within 6 hours, he's gone through 6 hearings and 2 major trials. What a sham of a trial. And that all takes place and is over by 6 a.m. So here's what happened in that last hearing. Pilate finds no fault. He came out and said, behold the man. That's recorded in John. The Jews said, we have a law, he ought to die. He asked Jesus where he's from. And the Jews said, if you release him, you're not Caesar's friend. Pilate's wife said, have nothing to do with him. They said, release unto us Jesus. And what shall I do with the Christ? Crucify him. What evil has he done? Pilate washes his hands, symbolizing, I don't have anything to do with this. And he says, behold your king. He scourged him, and then he delivered him to be crucified. Now let's go back to verse 16 and 22. What's involved in a scourging? Some have suggested this is somewhat of the tools that would be used to scourge. Those what looks like knots would be stones, pieces of bone or stone or some kind of metal, so that when you hit the person and pull that, it's like taking a knife and filleting their back. One writer suggests that the arms were outstretched around a pole so that their back is tight so that they can just basically lay the back open. Others have suggested they put their hands over their head and tied them. Whatever the case, the Jews had a law that you could, it was 40 stripes minus one, so they could hit them 39 times. That would often take an eye out. Sometimes it would kill them. The Romans didn't have that kind of limitation of 40 minus one. How many lashes did he get? I don't know. But they hadn't crucified him yet. We ain't got there yet. But he scourges him. That's not meant he said, I will. Other text says he did. He scourged him and then sent him off to be crucified. It's not over yet. All right. So here's what takes place in this trial. What a sham of a trial. If you're interested, and some of you have already shared with some articles from Roy Cogdell on the illegal nature of the trial, there's a whole passel of things that made it illegal. I'll share that with you if you'll send me an email. That includes people watching online. If you'll send me an email to the church's address, we'll get that to you. But the arrest was illegal. The indictment was illegal. The procedure was illegal on every turn. This was a sham of a trial. I don't have time to go into the details of that, but the trial is now over. Now we're ready for the crucifixion. So let's pick up at verse 26. And we have the journey from to Calvary. So let's get verses 26 to 32. As he's carrying, the custom was for a man to carry his own cross. That's part of the humiliation of dying by execution. And so he buckles under the pressure, and they seek the help of Simon a Cyrenian. Cyrene was on the northern point of the coast of Africa. He's a long way from home. And have him to bear the cross for Jesus. There was a multitude following. Now, verse 28 through verse 31 is quite interesting. This is a statement that Jesus makes to the women and the people and the multitude that's following, and they're weeping. Basically, two things he says. What are they? Summarizing. I'm not asking for the exact wording. Absolutely. Absolutely. Don't cry for me, but cry for yourself. Now, here's what he says. Notice he turns and said, daughters of Jerusalem, do not weep for me, but weep for yourselves and for your children. That's what he's talking about. I think he's pointing to what he'd said just a few days before about the destruction of Jerusalem. For indeed the days are coming in which you'll say, blessed are the barren, the wombs that never bore, and the breasts that never nursed. Now, that sounds like, that's not, you would not normally say that. Boy, it's better if a people don't have children and they never bore children, never had children, and never raised children. Wouldn't that be great? Well, in some circumstances, it's a lot better. When you face the destruction of Jerusalem, it's going to be a lot better if you didn't have any children. That's what he's talking about. Then they will begin to say, to the mountains, fall on us, and the hills, cover us. That's better than going through that destruction. Matthew 24 said there'd been nothing like it before or after. Now, verse 31 is the kicker. For if they do these things in the green wood, what will be done in the dry? So what's that about? Well, if you know anything about building a fire, if you have some green wood and some dry wood, you start a fire and you have the green wood on it, it burns slower. But if you throw a green log on a fire and it burns up like that, what do you think is going to happen to that dry log? It ain't going to last as long, is it? It burns up even quicker. So what's he talking about? I think what he's saying is, if these kinds of things that they're witnessing, this is going on with the innocent, how much more so the destruction of those that are guilty? Does that make sense? I think he's alluding to the destruction of Jerusalem and the punishment of the Jewish nation. If this is being done to the innocent, the sinless, what's going to happen to those that are guilty? Don't worry about me. You need to be worrying about those that are guilty. What a statement, knowing he's headed to the cross. Now, beginning at verse 33 is where they put him on the cross. Verse 33. And when they came to the place called Calvary, they crucified him, a criminal on one hand and a criminal on the other. Now, let's pause for a moment. Where did that take place? The true answer to that is we don't know for sure. Tradition said, this is a map of Jerusalem, that Golgotha, the place of the skull, Calvary, is in this northwestern corner of Jerusalem. That's still the traditional thought today. Here's a modern map from Lagos of Jerusalem. You can't see much, but what we're about to zero in on is this circle right here. And there you'll see the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. So what's that about? Well, when you get there, you see a building like this. And that's the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. And underneath this Church of the Holy Sepulchre is what is thought to be the slope where Jesus was crucified at Golgotha. Is it? We don't know. But several scholars say we have no reason to question that that underneath this is supposed to be the place where Jesus was crucified and where he was buried. Is it? Well, the true answer is, I don't know. What do you think, Jim? Go.
And it makes you think that
maybe
that might
be.
And then there's another tomb that is just right down below that would duplicate what you see in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre.
Yes, good point. And I didn't have pictures. I've got pictures of that skull, place of the skull, what looks like in the modern picture. It does look like a skull. So somewhere in that northern region is where all that took place. You're getting close. Absolutely. All right, let's talk about the events while on the cross, beginning at verse 34. We've got just a few minutes, so let's see if we can wrap all this together here. We're at point C in our outline, and he's been put on the cross, but he doesn't die immediately. So we want to get a time stamp here in just a moment. Here's some things that take place. If you're so disposed to highlight, there are seven statements that Jesus makes while on the cross. Three of them are flagged in our text today. Four of them are found elsewhere. They're not in Luke. We're only going to flag three. The first one is in verse 34. He said, Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they do. I've got a question on that. I'm going to answer in interest of time. That was not an unconditional, I'm forgiving them. Acts 2 is where he forgave them. Those that had cried, crucify him, crucify him. Peter makes the point in Acts 2 that you're the ones who crucified and slain him, and they were told to repent and be baptized for the remission of sins. So on what conditions? Well, it was the conditions stated in Acts 2. That's another story. They cast lots for his garments. So can you imagine you're hung on the cross and they're playing a game of chance who gets and gets part of your garments? Verse 35 to 37, they mocked him. How'd they mock him? Yeah, if you can save others, save yourself. If you're king of the Jews, save yourself. And then they put a banner or an inscription over him in what languages? And what did it say? They tried to talk Pilate into changing that, and he wouldn't. That's not recorded here. That's recorded in Matthew. And now we have the discussion with the two thieves. So you get ready to make a marginal note if you so care to do that. Luke's account sounds like one of the thieves mocked him or ridiculed Jesus, but both of them started. And so how do I know that? Matthew 27, 44. Both of them started in on him. But in this discussion, one of the criminals blasphemed him, saying, if you're the Christ, save yourself and us. And the other one rebuked him, seemingly after he had started, do you not even fear God, seeing we're under the same condemnation, that we indeed justly receive the reward, but this man has done nothing wrong. And then he turns to Jesus and asks, when you come into your kingdom, and he says to him, there's your second of the seven phrases. Not second in order, but the second one mentioned here. So that's the second thing that this text states that he said while on the cross. Today shall you be with me in paradise. All right. Now then, there was darkness over the face of the earth, 44 and 45, from the sixth hour unto the ninth hour. That's from noon to 3. Got that? From noon to 3. For 3 hours, there's darkness over the face of the earth. And the sun was darkened, and what else happened? The veil of the temple was torn in two, ripped from top to bottom, indicating the way into the most holy place has been made possible through the death of Christ. And then Jesus says at verse 46, here's your third of the seven statements, not third in order, but third in our text. Into thy hand I commend my spirit. And then he breathed his last, which means he died. All right, so verse 46 says he died. And then we have some events after the cross. Now, let's talk about him being on the cross. He was put on the cross, we've already mentioned, about 9 o'clock. So he was on the cross from 9 to 3, and at least. There were three statements he made in the first part of that, first 3 hours. The second 3 hours, when it was dark, he made four statements. Let's see what those are. I highlighted the statements. He said, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." The second one, John mentions he commended his mother into John's care. And the third one, "Today shalt thou be with me in paradise." The fourth was, "Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani." The next one was, "I thirst." And the next one was, "It is finished." And then the last was, "Into thy hands I commend my spirit." There's your seven statements on the cross. Does that make sense? All right. Before we go any further, I just want to mention death by crucifixion. How does a person die by crucifixion? They don't die because they're hanging on the cross. That's not what kills them. Suffocation. They die by suffocation. You can't breathe. They can't exhale. So you think of everything else that's happened, and now he suffocates to death. And then they pierced his side, John 19. All right. Now let's go to verses 47 to 48. After his death, what did the centurion say? "This certainly was a righteous man." Matthew 15 says he was the Son of God. Verse 39. The whole crowd began to watch on. The women followed from a distance and watched from a distance. I'm more interested now in going to catch this last section quickly if we can. Let's talk about the burial. Joseph, who is Joseph? All right. He's of the Sanhedrin Council. He's from Arimathea, about 5 miles north of Jerusalem is where he's from. And he was on the council. He was a just man, but he didn't consent to the council. That answers a question we've been talking about, that the council was not in 100% agreement. Because he didn't consent to the council or to the deeds. He was from Arimathea. He was a man who was watching for the kingdom. And he goes to Pilate and asks for the body. Now, what did he do with the body? Verse 53. This is important when we get to the resurrection. He placed his body in his own tomb, and it's a new tomb, which means no body's been laid there. There's not going to be a mistake that there's been a body and there's still a body in there. There's no body that's been in this tomb. It's hewn out of rock. It's solid. There's no way. It's not a cave where there's a back door. And so there's some flags there that we're supposed to pay attention to, that when we come to the resurrection, there's no reason for there to be an escape. Now, verse 54 is the preparation day for the Sabbath. That's the day before the Sabbath. So that tells us this day is Friday. Remember our calendar? It's Friday. And so there were women who prepared spices. We'll see what they're trying to do with that in chapter 24. And they rest on the Sabbath, and they're getting ready to come back the next day, expecting to find the body of Jesus. Making sense? Making sense? All right, we've been through trial. They've crucified him. He's now in the tomb. And now the next thing is he's going to be raised from the dead. A surprise even to the disciples who were told this was going to happen. And we'll get to that next time. We are done.